when you can't produce a corpse, a weapon, or witnesses. Despite Dr. Bramble's physiological brilliance and Dr. Lieberman's fossil expertise, there was no way they could prove that our legs were once lethal weapons if they couldn't show that someone, somewhere, had actually run an animal to death. You can spout any theory you want about human performance. We can suspend our own heartbeats. We can bend spoons with our brains. But in the end, you can't make the shift from appealing notion to empirical fact if you don't come up with the goods. The frustrating thing is, we were finding stories all over the place, David Carrier said. Throw a dart at the map, and chances are you'll bullseye the site of a persistence hunting tail. The Goshutes and Papago tribes of the American West told them. So did the Kalahari Bushmen in Botswana, the Aborigines in Australia, Maasai warriors in Kenya, the Seri and Tarahumara Indians in Mexico. The trouble was, those legends were fourth or fifth hand at best. There was as much evidence to support them as there was that Davy Crockett killed him a bar when he was only three. We couldn't find anyone who'd done a persistence hunt, David said. We couldn't find someone who'd even seen one. No wonder the scientific community remained skeptical. If the running man theory was right, then at least one person on this planet of 6 billion should be able to catch quarry on foot. We may have lost the tradition and necessity, but we should still have the native ability. Our DNA hasn't changed in centuries and is 99.9% identical across the globe, meaning we've all got the same stock parts as any ancient hunter-gatherer. So how come none of us could catch a stinking deer? That's why I decided to do it myself, David said. As an undergrad, I got into mountain races and had a lot of fun at those. So when it came to how humans breathe differently when we run, I think it was easier for me to see how it could affect us as a species. The idea didn't seem as strange to me as it would for someone who never left the lab. Nor did it seem strange to him that if he couldn't find a caveman, he could become one. In the summer of 1984, David persuaded his brother, Scott, a freelance writer and reporter for National Public Radio, to go to Wyoming and help him catch a wild antelope. Scott wasn't much of a runner, but David was in great shape and fiercely motivated by the lure of scientific immortality. Between him and his brother, David figured, it should take only 2 hours before 800 pounds of proof was flopping at his feet. We drive off the interstate and down a dirt road for a few miles, and it's a wide and open high desert of sagebrush, dry as a bone, mountains in every direction. There are antelope everywhere. That's how Scott later painted the scene for listeners on NPR's This American Life. We stop the car and start running after three, a buck and two does. They run very quickly, but for short distances, and then stop and stare at us till we catch up. Then they take off again. Sometimes they run a quarter of a mile, sometimes a half mile. Perfect. It was playing out exactly as David had predicted. The antelope weren't getting enough time to cool off before David and Scott were yip-yip-yahooing on their tails again. A few more miles of this, David figured, and he'd be heading back to Salt Lake with a trunk full of venison and a killer video to slap down on Dr. Bramble's desk. His brother, on the other hand, sensed something very different going on. The three antelope look at me like they know exactly what we're proposing, and they're not the least bit worried, Scott continues. It didn't take him long to find out why they were so calm in the face of what should have been impending death. Instead of flopping over in exhaustion, the antelope pulled a shell game. When they got winded, they circled back and hid in the herd, leaving David and Scott no idea which antelopes were tired and which were fresh. They blend and flow and change positions, Scott says. There are no individuals, but this mass that moves across the desert like a pool of mercury on a glass table. For two more days, the two brothers chased mercury balls across the Wyoming plains, never realizing they were in the midst of a magnificent mistake. David's failure was unwitting proof of his own theory. Human running is different from any other running on Earth. You can't catch other animals by copying them, and especially not by using the crude approximation of animal running we've preserved in sports. David and Scott We're relying on instinct, strength, and stamina without realizing that human distance running, at its evolutionary best, is much more than that. It's a blend of strategy and skill perfected during millions of years of do-or-die decisions. And like any other fine art, human distance running demands a brain-body connection that no other creature is capable of. But it's a lost art, as Scott Carrier would spend the next decade discovering. Something strange happened out there on the Wyoming plains. The lure of the lost art got into Scott's blood and wouldn't let go. Despite the hopelessness of that expedition, Scott spent years researching persistence hunting on his brother's behalf. He even created a nonprofit corporation devoted to finding the last of the long-distance hunters and recruited elite ultra-runner Creighton King, the double Grand Canyon record holder before the Skaggs Bros came along, to join an expedition to the Sea of Cortez, where word had it that a tiny clan of Seri Indians had preserved the link to our distance-running past. Scott found the clan, but he found them too late. Two elders had learned old-style running from their father, but they were a half-century out of practice and too old to even demonstrate. That was the end of the trail. By 2004, the hunt for that one person in 6 billion had lasted 20 years and gone nowhere. Scott Carrier gave up. David Carrier had moved on long before and was now studying physical combat structures in primates. The last of the long-distance hunters was a cold case. Naturally, that's when the phone rang. "So out of the blue, I find myself talking to this stranger," Dr. Bramble begins. He looks like an old cowpoke with his shaggy gray hair and crisp rancher shirt, and it's a style that perfectly matches the dried animal skulls on the walls of his lab and his enthralling gather-round-the-campfire storytelling. By 2004, Dr. Bramble says, the Utah-Harvard team had identified 26 distance-running markers on the human body. With little hope of ever finding the last hunter, they decided to go ahead and publish their findings anyway. Nature magazine put them on the cover, and a copy apparently made its way to a beach town on the South African coast, because that's where this call was coming from. "It's not hard to run an antelope to death," the stranger said. "I can show you how it's done." "Sorry. Who are you?"
"Louis Liebenberg, from Nordhook."
Bramble knew all the top names in the running theory field, which wasn't hard since they could fit around a diner booth. Louis Liebenberg from Nordhook, he'd never heard of.
"Are you a hunter?" Bramble asked.
"Me? No."
"Oh, anthropologist?"
"No."
"What's your field?"
"Math. Math and physics."
"Math?
How did a mathematician run down an antelope?" Bramble heard a snort of laughter. "By accident, mostly." It's eerie how the lives of Louis Liebenberg and David Carrier spiraled each other for decades without either of them knowing it. Back in the early 80s, Louis was also an undergraduate in college, and like David, he was suddenly electrified by an insight into human evolution that few others believed in. Part of Louis's problem was his expertise. He had none. At the time, he was barely 20 and majoring in applied mathematics and physics at the University of Cape Town. It was while taking an elective course in the philosophy of science that he started wondering about the Big Bang of the human mind. How did we leap from basic survival thinking, like that of other animals, to wildly complicated concepts like logic, humor, deduction, abstract reasoning, and creative imagination? Okay, so primitive man upgraded his hardware with a bigger brain, but where did he get the software? Growing a bigger brain is an organic process, but being able to use that brain to project into the future and mentally connect, say, a kite, a key, and a lightning bolt, and come up with electrical transference, was like a touch of magic. So where did that spark of inspiration come from? The answer, Louis believed, was out in the deserts of southern Africa. Even though he was a city kid who knew jack about the outdoors, he had a hunch that the best place to look for the birth of human thought was the place where human life began. I had a vague gut feeling that the art of animal tracking could represent the origin of science itself, Lewis says. Then who better to study than the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert, who were both masters of animal tracking and living remnants of our prehistoric past? So, at age 22, Lewis decided to drop out of college and write a new chapter in natural history by testing his theory with the Bushmen. It was an insanely ambitious plan for a college dropout with zero experience in anthropology, wilderness survival, or scientific method. He spoke neither the Bushmen's native tongue, Kabi, nor their adopted one, Afrikaans. He didn't even know anything about animal tracking, the reason he was going in the first place. But so what? Lewis shrugged and got to work. He found an Afrikaans translator, made contact with hunting guides and anthropologists, and eventually set off down the Trans-Kalahari Highway into Botswana, Namibia, and the unknown. Like Scott Carrier, Lewis soon discovered that he was losing a race against time. "I went village to village looking for bushmen who hunt with bow and arrow, since they'd have the tracking skills," Lewis says. "But with big game safaris and ranchers taking over their old game lands, most of the bushmen had abandoned the nomadic life and were living on government settlements. Their decline was heartbreaking. Instead of roaming the wilderness, many of the bushmen were surviving on slave wages for farm jobs and seeing their sisters and daughters recruited by truck stop bordellos." Lewis kept searching. Far out in the Kalahari, he finally came across a renegade band of bushmen who, he says, stubbornly clung to freedom and independence and wouldn't subject themselves to manual labor or prostitution. As it turned out, the search for 1 in 6 billion was just about mathematically correct. In all the Kalahari, only 6 true hunters remained. The renegades agreed to let Lewis hang around, an offer he took to the extreme. Once installed, Lewis acted like an unemployed in-law, basically squatting with the bushmen for the next 4 years. The city kid from Cape Town learned to live on the bushman diet of roots, berries, porcupine, and rat-like spring hares. He learned to keep his campfire burning and tent zipped, even on the most sweltering nights, since packs of hyenas were known to drag people from open shelters and tear out their throats. He learned that if you stumble upon an angry lioness and her cubs, you stand tall and make her back down. But in the same situation with a rhino, you run like hell. When it comes to mentors, you can't beat survival. Just trying to fill his belly every day and avoid pissing off, for instance, 2 black-backed jackals mating beneath a baobab, was an excellent way for Lewis to begin absorbing the wizardry of a master tracker. He learned to look at piles of zebra dung and distinguish which droppings came from which animal. Intestines, he discovered, have ridges and grooves that leave unique patterns on feces. Learn to tell them apart, and you can single out a zebra from an exploding herd and track it for days by its distinctive droppings. Lewis learned to hunch over a set of fox tracks and recreate exactly what it was doing. Here it was moving slowly as it scented around for mice and scorpions. And look, that's where it trotted off with something in its mouth. A swirl of swept dirt told him where an ostrich had taken a dust bath and let him backtrack to find its eggs. Meerkats make their warrens in hardpan, so why were they digging here in soft sand? Must mean there's a den of tasty scorpions. Even after you learn to read dirt, you ain't learned nothing. The next level is tracking without tracks, a higher state of reasoning known in the lit as speculative hunting. The only way you can pull it off, Lewis discovered, was by projecting yourself out of the present and into the future, transporting yourself into the mind of the animal you're tracking. Once you learn to think like another creature, you can anticipate what it will do and react before it ever acts. If that sounds a little Hollywood, then you've seen your share of movies about impossibly clairvoyant FBI profilers who can see with the eyes of a killer. But out there on the Kalahari Plains, mind-throwing was a very real and potentially deadly talent. When tracking an animal, One attempts to think like an animal in order to predict where it is going, Lewis says. Looking at its tracks, one visualizes the motion of the animal and feels that motion in one's own body. You go into a trance-like state. The concentration is so intense. It's actually quite dangerous because you can become numb to your own body and can keep pushing yourself until you collapse. Visualization, empathy, abstract thinking and forward projection. Aside from the keeling over part, isn't that exactly the mental engineering we now use for science, medicine, the creative arts? When you track, you're creating causal connections in your mind because you didn't actually see what the animal did, Lewis realized. That's the essence of physics. With speculative hunting, early human hunters had gone beyond connecting the dots. They were now connecting dots that existed only in their minds. One morning, four of the renegade bushmen, Nate, Namkabe, Kayate, and Borohau, woke Lewis up before dawn to invite him on a special hunt. "Don't eat any breakfast," they warned him, "and drink all the water you can hold." Lewis downed a mug of coffee, grabbed his boots, and fell in behind the hunters as they marched off across the savannah in the dark. The sun rose until it was broiling over their heads, but the hunters pushed on. Finally, after walking nearly 20 miles, they spotted a clutch of kudu, an especially agile form of antelope. That's when the bushmen started to run. Lewis stood there, confused. He knew the standard bushman bow hunting drill. Drop to your belly, creep into arrow range, let fly. So what the hell was this all about? He'd heard a little about persistence hunts, but he ranked them somewhere between an accident and a lie. Either the animal had actually broken its neck while fleeing, or the story was out-and-out baloney. No way these guys were going to catch one of those kudus on foot. No way. But the more he said, no way, the farther away the bushman got. So Lewis quit thinking and started running. "This is how we do it," Nate said when a panting Lewis caught up. The four hunters ran swiftly but easily behind the bounding kudu. Whenever the animals darted into an acacia grove, one of the hunters broke from the group and drove the kudu back into the sun. The herd would scatter, reform, scatter again, but the four bushmen ran and swerved behind a single kudu, cutting it out of the herd whenever it tried to blend, flushing it from the trees whenever it tried to rest. If they had a doubt about which one to chase, they dropped to the ground, checked the tracks, and adjusted their pursuit. As he gasped along behind the band, Lewis was surprised to find Nate, the strongest and most skilled hunter of the renegade bushmen, hanging back with him. Nate wasn't even carrying a canteen like the other hunters. Nearly 90 minutes into the pursuit, Lewis discovered why. When one of the older hunters tired and dropped out, he handed his canteen to Nate. Nate drank it dry, then traded it for a half-full one when a second runner dropped out. Lewis staggered along behind, determined to see the hunt through to the end. He was bitterly regretting his choice of heavy bush boots. The bushmen traditionally wore light giraffe skin moccasins, and now had on thin, flimsy sneakers that let their feet cool on the fly. Lewis felt the way the kudu looked. He watched it weave drunkenly. Its front knees buckled, straightened. It recovered and bounded away, then crashed to the ground. So did Lewis. By the time he got to the fallen kudu, he was so overheated he'd stopped sweating. He pitched face down into the sand. "When you're focused on the hunt, you push to the limits. You're not aware you're exhausted," Lewis later explained. In a way, he triumphed. Lewis had managed to cross over and run as hard as if he were the one being pursued. Where he failed was not knowing to check his own footprints. Because it's so easy to become numb to your own vital signs, the bushmen learned long ago to periodically check their own tracks. If their prints looked as bad as the kudu's, they'd stop, wash their faces, hold a mouthful of water, and slowly let it trickle down their throats. After the final swallow, they'd walk and check their tracks again. Lewis's head was pounding and his dry eyes were going blurry. He was barely conscious, but still alert enough to be really scared. He was lying in the desert in 107-degree heat, and he knew he had only one chance to save his life. He fumbled for his belt knife and reached toward the dead kudu. If he could slash it open, he could suck the water from its stomach.
No!
Nate stopped Lewis. Unlike other antelopes, kudus eat acacia leaves, which are poisonous for humans. Nate calmed Lewis, told him to hold on a little longer, and took off running. Even though Nate had already hiked 20 miles and run 15, he was able to run 12 more miles to bring Lewis back some water. Nate wouldn't let him drink it. First, he rinsed Lewis's head. Then he washed his face. And only after Lewis's skin began to cool did Nate allow him tiny sips. Later, after Nate had helped him back to camp, Lewis marveled at the ruthless efficiency of the persistence hunt. "It's much more efficient than a bow and arrow," he observed. "It takes a lot of attempts to get a successful hunt by bow. You can hit the animal and still lose it, or scavengers can smell blood and get to it before you do. Or it can take all night for the poison on the arrow tips to work. Only a small percentage of arrow shots are successful, so for the number of days hunting, the meat yield of a persistence hunt is much higher." Lewis found out only in his second, third, and fourth persistence hunts how lucky he'd gotten in the first. That debut kudu dropped after only 2 hours, but everyone after that kept the bushman on the run for 3 to 5 hours, neatly corresponding, one might note, to how long it takes most people to run our latter-day version of prehistoric hunting, the marathon. Recreation has its reasons. To succeed as a hunter, Lewis had to reinvent himself as a runner. He'd been an excellent middle-distance athlete in high school, winning the 1500-meter championship and finishing a close second in the 800. But to hang with the Bushmen, he had to forget everything he'd been taught by modern coaches and study the ancients. As a track athlete, he'd drop his head and hammer. But as an apprentice Bushman, he had to be eyes high and tinglingly alert every step of the way. He couldn't zone out and ignore pain. Instead, his mind was constantly tap-dancing between the immediate, scratches in the dust, sweat on his own forehead, and the imaginary, as he played mental war games to think one step ahead of his prey. The pace wasn't too fierce. The Bushmen average about 10 minutes a mile, but many of those miles are in soft sand and brush, and they occasionally stop to study tracks. They'd still fire the jets and take off at a sprint, but they knew how to keep trotting afterward and recover on the run. They had to, because a persistence hunt was like showing up at the starting line without knowing if you were running a half marathon, marathon, or ultra. After a while, Lewis began to look at running the way other people look at walking. He learned to settle back and let his legs spin in a quick, easy trot, a sort of baseline motion that could last all day and leave him enough reserves to accelerate when necessary. His eating changed, too. As a hunter-gatherer, you're never off the clock. You can be walking home after an exhausting day of collecting yams, but if fresh game scuttles into view, you drop everything and go. So Lewis had to learn to graze, eating lightly throughout the day, rather than filling up on big meals, never letting himself get thirsty, treating every day as if he were in a race that had already started. The Kalahari summer cooled into winter, but the hunts continued. The Utah-Harvard docs would turn out to be wrong about one part of their running man theory. Persistence hunting doesn't depend on killer heat, because the ingenious Bushmen had devised ways to run down game in every weather. In the rainy season, both the tiny Duker antelope and the giant Gemsbok, with its lance-like horns, would overheat because the wet sand splayed their hooves, forcing their legs to churn harder. The 400-pound red hartebeest is comfortable in waist-high grasslands, but exposed and vulnerable when the ground parches during dry winters. Come the full moon, antelopes are active all night and tired by daybreak. Come spring, they're weakened by diarrhea from feasting on green leaves. By the time Lewis was ready to head home from the bush and begin writing The Art of Tracking, The Origin of Science, he'd gotten so accustomed to epic runs that he almost took them for granted. He barely mentions running in his book, focusing more on the mental demands of the hunt than the physical. It was only after a copy of Nature magazine fell into his hands that he fully appreciated what he'd seen out there in the Kalahari and grabbed the phone to dial Utah. "Know why people run marathons?" he told Dr. Bramble. "Because running is rooted in our collective imagination, and our imagination is rooted in running. Language, art, science, space shuttles, starry night, intravascular surgery, they all had their roots in our ability to run. Running was the superpower that made us human, which means it's a superpower all humans possess." "Then why do so many people hate it?" I asked Dr. Bramble as he came to the end of the story of Lewis and the Bushmen. "If we're all born to run, shouldn't all of us enjoy it?" Dr. Bramble began his answer with a riddle. "This is fascinating stuff," he said. "We monitored the results of the 2004 New York City Marathon and compared finishing times by age. What we found is that starting at age 19, runners get faster every year until they hit their peak at 27. After 27, they start to decline. So here's the question. How old are you when you're back to running the same speed you did at 19? All righty. I flipped my notebook to a blank page and started jotting numbers. It takes 8 years until you run your best time at age 27. If you get slower at the same rate you got faster, then you'd be back at your 19-year-old time by age 36. 8 years up, 8 years down. But I knew there was a twist involved, and I was pretty sure it had to be whether we fade away as quickly as we improve. We probably hang on to our speed a little longer once we get it, I decided. Khalid Kanouchi was 26 when he broke the marathon world record, and was still fast enough at 36 to finish in the top four at the 2008 U.S. Olympic trials. He'd lost only 10 minutes in 10 years, despite a ton of injuries. In honor of the Kanouchi curve, I bumped my answer up to 40. 40, I started to say, until I saw the smile creasing Bramble's face. 5, I hastily added. I'll guess 45. Wrong. 50? Nope. It can't be 55. You're right, Bramble said. It can't be. It's 64. Are you serious? I scribbled out the math. That's a 45-year difference. You're saying teenagers can't beat guys three times their age? Isn't that amazing? Bramble agreed. Name any other field of athletic endeavor where 64-year-olds are competing with 19-year-olds. Swimming? Boxing? Not even close. There's something really weird about us humans. We're not only really good at endurance running, we're really good at it for a remarkably long time. We're a machine built to run, and the machine never wears out. You don't stop running because you get old, the dipsy demon always said. You get old because you stop running. And it's true for both genders, Dr. Bramble continued. Women show the same results as men. That makes sense, since a curious transformation came over us when we came down from the trees. The more we became human, the more we became equal. Men and women are basically the same size, at least compared with other primates. Male gorillas and orangutans weigh twice as much as their better halves. Male chimps are a good one-third bigger than females. But between the average human him and the average human her, the difference in bulk is only a slim 15%. As we evolved, we shucked our beef and became more sinuous, more cooperative, essentially, more female. Women have really been underrated, Dr. Bramble said. They've been evolutionarily shortchanged. We perpetuate this notion that they were sitting around waiting for the men to come back with food, but there's no reason why women couldn't be part of the hunting party.
Actually, it would be weird if women weren't hunting alongside the men, since they're the ones who really need the meat. The human body benefits most from meat protein during infancy, pregnancy, and lactation. So why wouldn't women get as close to the beef supply as possible? Hunter-gatherer nomads shift their camps by the movements of the herds. So instead of hauling food back to camp, it made more sense for the whole camp to go to the food. And caring for kids on the fly isn't that hard, as American ultra-runner Cammie Semmick demonstrates. She likes to run mountain trails around Bend, Oregon, with her 4-year-old daughter, Barony, riding along in a backpack. Newborns? No problem. At the 2007 Hard Rock 100, Emily Bear beat 90 other men and women to finish 8th overall while stopping at every aid station to breastfeed her infant son. The Bushmen are no longer nomadic, but the equal partners in hunting tradition still exists among the Mbuti pygmies of the Congo, where husbands and wives with nets pursue the giant forest hog side by side. Since they are perfectly capable of giving birth to a child while on the hunt, then rejoining the hunt the same morning, notes anthropologist Colin Turnbull, who spent years among the Mbuti, mothers see no reason why they should not continue to participate fully. Dr. Bramble's picture of the past was taking on clarity and color. I could see a band of hunters, young and old, male and female, running tirelessly across the grasslands. The women are up front, leading the way toward fresh tracks they spotted while foraging, and hard behind are the old men, their eyes on the ground and their minds inside a kudu skull a half mile ahead. Crowding their heels are teens eager to soak up tips. The real muscle hangs back. The guys in their 20s, the strongest runners and hunters, watching the lead trackers and saving their strength for the kill. And bringing up the rear? The Cammie Semmicks of the savannah, toting their kids and grandkids. After all, what else did we have going for us? Nothing, except we ran like crazy and stuck together. Humans are among the most communal and cooperative of all primates. Our sole defense in a fang-filled world was our solidarity, and there's no reason to think we suddenly disbanded during our most crucial challenge, the hunt for food. I remembered what the Seri Indians told Scott Carrier after the sun had set on their persistence hunting days. "It was better before," a Seri elder lamented. "We did everything as a family. The whole community was a family. We shared everything and cooperated. But now there's a lot of arguing and bickering. Every man for himself." Running didn't just make the Seris a people. As Coach Joe Vigil would later sense about his own athletes, it also made them better people. "But there's a problem," Dr. Bramble said. He tapped his forehead. "And it's right up here." "Our greatest talent," he explained, "also created the monster that could destroy us. Unlike any other organism in history, humans have a mind-body conflict. We have a body built for performance, but a brain that's always looking for efficiency. We live or die by our endurance, but remember, endurance is all about conserving energy, and that's the brain's department. The reason some people use their genetic gift for running and others don't is because the brain is a bargain shopper. For millions of years, we lived in a world without cops, cabs, or Domino's pizza. We relied on our legs for safety, food, and transportation. And it wasn't as if you could count on one job ending before the next one began. Look at Nate's wild hunt with Lewis. Nate sure wasn't planning on a fast 10K immediately after a half-day hike and a high-speed hunt. But he still found the reserve energy to save Lewis's life. Nor could his ancestors ever be sure that they wouldn't become food right after catching some. The antelope they'd chased since dawn could attract fiercer animals, forcing the hunters to drop lunch and run for their lives. The only way to survive was to leave something in the tank, and that's where the brain comes in. The brain is always scheming to reduce costs, get more for less, store energy, and have it ready for an emergency, Bramble explained. You've got this fancy machine, and it's controlled by a pilot who's thinking, okay, how can I run this baby without using any fuel? You and I know how good running feels because we've made a habit of it. But lose the habit, and the loudest voice in your ear is your ancient survival instinct urging you to relax. And there's the bitter irony. Our fantastic endurance gave our brain the food it needed to grow, and now our brain is undermining our endurance. We live in a culture that sees extreme exercise as crazy, Dr. Bramble says, because that's what our brain tells us. Why fire up the machine if you don't have to? To be fair, our brain knew what it was talking about for 99% of our history. Sitting around was a luxury, so when you had the chance to rest and recover, you grabbed it. Only recently have we come up with the technology to turn lazing around into a way of life. We've taken our sinewy, durable, hunter-gatherer bodies and plunked them into an artificial world of leisure. And what happens when you drop a life form into an alien environment? NASA scientists wondered the same thing before the first space flights. The human body had been built to thrive under the pressure of gravity, so maybe taking away that pressure would act as an escape trajectory fountain of youth, leaving the astronauts feeling stronger, smarter, and healthier. After all, every calorie they ate would now go toward feeding their brains and bodies, instead of pushing up against that relentless downward pull, right? Not by a long shot. By the time the astronauts returned to Earth, they'd aged decades in a matter of days. Their bones were weaker and their muscles had atrophied. They had insomnia, depression, acute fatigue, and listlessness. Even their taste buds had decayed. If you've ever spent a long weekend watching TV on the sofa, you know the feeling. Because down here on Earth, we've created our own zero-gravity bubble. We've taken away the jobs our bodies were meant to do, and we're paying for it. Nearly every top killer in the Western world, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, depression, hypertension, and a dozen forms of cancer, was unknown to our ancestors. They didn't have medicine, but they did have a magic bullet. Or maybe two, judging by the number of digits Dr. Bramble was holding up. You could literally halt epidemics in their tracks with this one remedy, he said. He flashed two fingers up in a peace sign, then slowly rotated them downward till they were scissoring through space. The running man. So simple, he said. Just move your legs. Because if you don't think you were born to run, you're not only denying history, you're denying who you are. Chapter 29. The past is never dead. It's not even past. William Faulkner, Requiem for a Nun. I was already awake and staring into the dark when Caballo came scratching at my door.
Also, he whispered.
Come on in, I whispered back. I blinked on my watch. 4:30. In half an hour, we were supposed to start out for our rendezvous with the Tarahumara. Months earlier, Caballo had told them to meet us in a little glen of shade trees on the trail up Batopilas Mountain. The plan was to push up and over the peak, then down the backside and across the river to the village of Urique. I didn't know what Caballo would do if the Tarahumara didn't show up, or what I'd do if they did. Travelers on horseback give themselves 3 days for the 35-mile journey from Batopilas to Urique. Caballo planned to do it in one. If I fell behind, would I be the one wandering lost in the canyons this time? And what if the Tarahumara didn't show? Would Caballo lead us into no man's land to search for them? Did he even know where he was going? Those were the thoughts that kept me from sleeping. But Caballo, it turned out, had worries of his own. He came in and sat on the edge of my bed. "Do you think the kids are up for it?" he asked. Remarkably, they seemed fine after their near-death day in the canyons. They'd put away a good meal of tortillas and frijoles that evening, and I hadn't heard any sounds of distress from the bathroom during the night. "How long till Giardia hits?" I asked. Giardia parasites, I knew, had to incubate for a while in the intestines before erupting into diarrhea, fever, and stomach cramps. "A week or two." "So, if they don't come down with something else by this morning, they might be okay till after the race."
"Hmm,"
Caballo muttered.
"Yeah."
He paused, obviously chewing over something else. "Look," he went on, "I'm going to have to pop Barefoot Ted between the eyes." The problem this time wasn't Ted's feet, it was his mouth. "If he gets in the face of the Rarámuri, they're going to get real uncomfortable," Caballo said. "They're going to think he's another fisher and split." "What are you going to do?" "I'm going to tell him he's got to keep it shut tight. I don't like telling people what to do, but he's got to get the message." I got up and helped him roust the others. The night before, a friend of Caballo's had loaded our bags on a burro and set off for Urique, so all we had to carry was enough food and water to get us there. Bob Francis, the old backcountry guide, had volunteered to drive Luis's father the long way around the mountain in his 4x4 pickup, sparing him the hike. Everyone else turned out quickly, and by 5 a.m., we were picking our way over the boulders toward the river. The canyon moon glittered on the water, and bats were still darting overhead as Caballo led us to a faint footpath skirting the waterline. We fitted into single file and shuffled into an easy jog. "The party kids are amazing," Eric said, watching them glide along behind Caballo. "They're more like the comeback kids," I agreed. "But Caballo's big worry is..." I pointed ahead to Barefoot Ted, whose outfit for the hike consisted of red shorts, his green five-finger toe shoes, and an anatomically correct skeleton amulet around his neck. Instead of a shirt, he wore a red raincoat with the hood knotted under his chin and the rest flapping loose over his shoulders like a cape. Jingling from his ankle was a string of bells, which he'd gotten because he'd read somewhere that Tarahumara elders wore them. "Good mojo," Eric grinned. "We've got our own witch doctor." By sunup, we'd left the river and turned up into the mountains. Caballo was pushing hard, even harder than he had the day before. We ate on the move, chomping down quick bites of tortilla and energy bars, sipping conservatively on our water in case it had to last all day. When it got light enough to see, I turned and looked back to get my bearings. The village had vanished like Brigadoon, swallowed whole by the forest. Even the trail behind us seemed to dissolve into the thick green foliage as soon as we passed. It felt like we were sinking into a bottomless green sea. "Not too much farther," I could hear Caballo saying. He was pointing to something I couldn't make out yet. "See that cluster of trees? That's where they'll be." "The Arnulfo," Luis said, wonder in his voice. "I'd rather meet him than Michael Jordan." I got closer and saw the trees. I didn't see any people. "The flu's been going around," Caballo said, slowing down and tilting back his head to squint at the hills above us for signs of life. "There's a chance some of the runners will come later, if they're sick, or if they have to take care of their families." Eric and I glanced at each other. Caballo had never mentioned anything about the flu before. I eased my hydration pack off my shoulders and got ready to sit down and rest. "Better take a break now till we see what's next," I thought, dropping the pack at my feet. When I looked back up, we were surrounded by half a dozen men in white skirts and pirate blouses. Between blinks, they'd materialized from the forest. We all stood, silent and stunned, waiting for a cue from Caballo.
"Is he here?" Luis whispered.
I scanned the ring of Tarahumara until I spotted that familiar whimsical smile on that handsome mahogany face.
Wow, he really came.
Just as unbelievably, his cousin Silvino was right beside him.
"That's him," I whispered back.
Arnulfo heard and glanced over. His lips twitched in a slight smile when he recognized me. Caballo was overcome with emotion. I thought it was just relief, until he reached out with both hands toward a Tarahumara runner with a mournful Geronimo-like face.
"Manuel," Caballo said.
Manuel Luna didn't return the smile, but he sandwiched both Caballo's hands with his own. I walked over. "I knew your son," I said. "He was very good to me, a real caballero."
"He told me about you," Manuel said. "He wanted to be here."
That emotional reunion between Caballo and Manuel broke the ice for everyone else.
The rest of Caballo's crew circulated among the Tarahumara, trading the special Tarahumara handshake Caballo had taught them, that light rasping of finger pads that is simultaneously less grasping and more intimate than a big old power pump. Caballo began introducing us, not by name. In fact, I don't think I ever heard him use our names again. He'd been studying us over the past 3 days, and just as he'd seen an oso in me, and Barefoot Ted had spotted a monkey in himself, Caballo felt he'd identified spirit animals for everyone else.
"El coyote," he said, laying a hand on Luis's back.
Billy became El lobo joven, the young wolf. Eric, quiet and ever watchful, was El gavilán, the hawk. When he got to Jen, I saw a flicker of amused interest briefly light up Manuel Luna's eyes.
La brujita bonita, Caballo called her.
To the Tarahumara, steeped in tales of their 2 magnificent years at Leadville and the epic battle between Juan Herrera and Anne the Bruja Trayson, calling a young runner the pretty little witch had exactly the punch of nicknaming an NBA rookie Air Jordan.
Hija?
Manuel asked. Was Jen really Anne Trayson's daughter?
Por sangre, no. Por corazón, sí, Caballo replied.
Not the same blood, but the same heart. Finally, Caballo turned to Scott Jurek.
El Venado, he said, which even got a reaction out of Too Cool Arnulfo.
Now, what was the crazy gringo playing at? Why would Caballo call the tall, lean, and supremely confident-looking guy the deer? Was he giving the Tarahumara a foot tap under the table? A little hint how to play their cards on race day? Manuel remembered very well the way Caballo had urged the Tarahumara in Leadville to sit patiently on Anne Trayson's heels and run her down like a deer. But would Caballo favor the Tarahumara over his own compatriot? Or maybe it was a setup. Maybe Caballo was trying to trick the Tarahumara into holding back while this American built an unbeatable lead. It was all mysterious and complicated and thoroughly entertaining to the Tarahumara, whose love of race strategy rivaled their taste for corned beer. Quietly, they began to banter among themselves until Barefoot Ted barged in. Whether accidentally or prophylactically, Caballo had bypassed Ted in the introductions, so Ted presented himself.
Yo soy el mono, he announced. The monkey.
Hang on, Barefoot Ted thought. Do they even have monkeys in Mexico? Maybe the Tarahumara don't know what a mono is. Just in case, he began hooting and scratching like a chimp, his ankle bells jingling and the sleeves of his red raincoat flapping in his face, somehow thinking that impersonating a thing they'd never heard of would let them know what that thing was. The Tarahumara stared. None of them, incidentally, wore bells.
Okay, Caballo said, eager to drop the curtain on this show. Vámonos?
We reshouldered our packs. We'd been on the climb for nearly 5 straight hours, but we had to keep racing the sun if we were going to have a chance of fording the river before dark. Caballo took point while the rest of us shuffled into single file among the Tarahumara. I tried to put myself last so I wouldn't slow down the parade, but Silvino wouldn't hear of it. He wouldn't move till I moved first.
¿Por qué? I asked. Why?
Habit, Silvino said. As one of the top ball racers in the canyons, he was used to keeping tabs on his teammates from the rear and letting them pull the pace until it was time for him to slingshot off for the final miles. I was tickled to think of myself as part of an all-star mixed Tarahumara American ultra-running team, until I translated what Silvino had said for Eric.
Maybe, Eric said.
Or maybe the race already started. He nodded farther ahead. Arnulfo was walking right behind Scott, watching him intently. Chapter 30. Poetry, music, forests, oceans, solitude. They were what developed enormous spiritual strength. I came to realize that spirit, as much or more than physical conditioning, had to be stored up before a race. Herb Elliott, Olympic champion and world record holder in the mile, who trained in bare feet, wrote poetry, and retired undefeated.
Oye, oso!
A shopkeeper called, waving me inside. 2 days after we'd arrived in Urique, we were known everywhere by the spirit animal nicknames Caballo had given us. Everywhere, of course, meant about 500 yards in every direction. Urique is a tiny, lost world village sitting alone at the bottom of the canyon, like a pebble at the bottom of a well. By the time we'd finished breakfast on our first morning, we'd already been folded into the local social life. An army squad encamped on the outskirts would salute Jen as they passed through on patrol, calling,
Hola, Brujita!
Kids greeted barefoot Ted with shouts of,
Buenos dias, señor mono!
Good morning, Mr. Monkey.
Hey, bear,
the shopkeeper continued. Do you know that Arnulfo has never been beaten? Do you know he's won the 100-kilometer race 3 times in a row? No Kentucky Derby, presidential election, or celebrity murder trial has ever been handicapped as passionately and personally as Caballo's race was by the people of Urique. As a mining village whose best days were over more than a century ago, Urique had 2 things left to be proud of: its brutally tough landscape and its Tarahumara neighbors. Now, for the first time, a pack of exotic foreign runners had traveled all this way to test themselves against both, and it had exploded into much more than a race. For the people of Urique, it was the one chance in their lifetime to show the outside world just what they were made of. And even Caballo was surprised to find that his race had surpassed his hopes and was growing into the ultimate fighting competition of underground ultras. Over the past 2 days, Tarahumara runners had continued trickling in by ones and twos from all directions. When we awoke the morning after our hike from Batopilas, we saw a band of local Tarahumara traipsing down from the hills above the village. Caballo hadn't even been sure the Urique Tarahumara still ran anymore. He'd been afraid that, as in the tragic case of the Tarahumara of Yerba Buena, government upgrades to the dirt road had converted the Urique Tarahumara from runners into hitchhikers. They certainly looked like a people in transition. The Urique Tarahumara still carried wooden palia sticks. Their version of the ball race was more like high-speed field hockey. But instead of traditional white skirts and sandals, they wore running shorts and sneakers from the Catholic mission. That same afternoon, Caballo was overjoyed to see a 51-year-old named Herbolisto come jogging in from Chinivo, accompanied by Nacho, a 41-year-old champion from one of Herbolisto's neighboring settlements. As Caballo had feared, Herbolisto had been laid up with the flu. But he was one of Caballo's oldest Tarahumara friends and hated the idea of missing the race. So as soon as he felt a little better, he grabbed a pinole bag and set off on the 60-mile trip on his own, stopping off on the way to invite Nacho along for the fun. By the eve of race day, our numbers had tripled from 8 to 25. Up and down Urique's main street, debate over who was now the true top seed was running hot. Was it Caballo Blanco, the wily old veteran who'd poached the secrets of both American and Tarahumara runners? Or the Urique Tarahumara, experts on the local trails who had hometown pride and support on their side? Some money was riding on Billy Bonehead, the young wolf, whose surf god physique drew admiring stares whenever he went for a swim in the Urique River. But the heaviest street action was divided between the two stars, Arnulfo, king of the Copper Canyons, and El Venado, his mysterious foreign challenger. Si, señor, I replied to the shopkeeper. Arnulfo won a 100-kilometer race in the canyons 3 times, but the deer has won a 100-mile race in the mountains 7 times. But it's very hot down here, the shopkeeper retorted. The Tarahumara, they eat heat. True, but the deer won a 135-mile race across a desert called Death Valley in the middle of summer. No one has ever run it faster. No one beats the Tarahumara, the shopkeeper insisted. So I've heard. So who are you betting on? He shrugged. The deer. The Urique villagers had grown up in awe of the Tarahumara, but this tall gringo with the flashy orange shoes was unlike anyone they'd ever seen. It was eerie watching Scott run side by side with Arnulfo. Even though Scott had never seen the Tarahumara before, and Arnulfo had never seen the outside world, somehow these two men separated by 2,000 years of culture had developed the same running style. They'd approached their art from opposite ends of history and met precisely in the middle. I first saw it up on Batopilas Mountain, after we'd finally gotten to the top and the trail flattened as it circled the peak. Arnulfo took advantage of the plateau to open it up, Scott locked in beside him. As the trail curled into the setting sun, the two of them vanished into the glare. For a few moments, I couldn't tell them apart. They were two fiery silhouettes moving with identical rhythm and grace.
"Got it," Luis said, dropping back to show me the image in his digital camera.
He'd sprinted ahead and wheeled around, just in time to capture everything I'd come to understand about running over the past 2 years. It wasn't Arnulfo's and Scott's matching form so much as their matching smiles. They were both grinning with sheer muscular pleasure, like dolphins rocketing through the waves. "This one is going to make me cry when I get back home," Luis said. "It's like getting Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle in the same shot." If Arnulfo had an advantage, it wouldn't be style or spirit. But I had another reason to put my money on Scott. During the last hardest miles of the hike to Urique, he kept hanging back with me, and I'd wondered why. He'd come all this way to see the best runners in the world, so why was he wasting his time with one of the worst? Didn't he resent me for holding everyone up? 7 hours of descending that mountain eventually gave me my answer. What Coach Joe Vigil sensed about character, what Dr. Bramble conjectured with his anthropological models, Scott had been his entire life. The reason we race isn't so much to beat each other, he understood, but to be with each other. Scott learned that before he had a choice, back when he was trailing Dusty and the boys through the Minnesota woods. He was no good and had no reason to believe he ever would be, but the joy he got from running was the joy of adding his power to the pack. Other runners try to disassociate from fatigue by blasting iPods or imagining the roar of the crowd in Olympic Stadium, but Scott had a simpler method. It's easy to get outside yourself when you're thinking about someone else. Footnote. Any doubts I had about this theory were laid to rest the following year, when I went to crew for Luis Escobar at Badwater. At 3 o'clock in the morning, I drove ahead to check on Scott and found him bearing down in the midst of a 4-mile-high hill. He'd already run 80 miles in 125-degree heat and was on pace for a new course record, but when he saw me, the first words out of his mouth were, "How's Coyote?" That's why the Tarahumara bet like crazy before a ball race. It makes them equal partners in the effort, letting the runners know they're all in it together. Likewise, the Hopis consider running a form of prayer. They offer every step as a sacrifice to a loved one, and in return ask the Great Spirit to match their strength with some of his own. Knowing that, it's no mystery why Arnulfo had no interest in racing outside the canyons, and why Silvino never would again. If they weren't racing for their people, then what was the point? Scott, whose sick mother never left his thoughts, was still a teenager when he absorbed this connection between compassion and competition. The Tarahumara drew strength from this tradition, I realized, but Scott drew strength from every running tradition. He was an archivist and an innovator, an omnivorous student who gave as much serious thought to the running lore of the Navajo, the Kalahari Bushmen, and the marathon monks of Mount Hiei as he did to aerobic levels, lactate thresholds, and the optimal recruitment of all three types of muscle twitch fiber, not two, as most runners believe. Arnulfo wasn't going up against a fast American. He was about to race the world's only 21st century Tarahumara. While the shopkeeper and I were busy setting the over-under, I saw Arnulfo strolling past. I grabbed a couple of popsicles to pay him back for the sweet limes he'd given me at his house
and together we went looking for a shady spot to relax. I saw Manuel Luna sitting under a tree, but he looked so alone and lost in thought